There we go. And we are live. Okay, so this session is being recorded. I generally record my class as they go on Wayu Torah. Again, if you want to eat cereal or something in the background, let me Shavasana for Thomas. But if you are eating, then you go ahead and do that. So the video I do not plan on sharing publicly. The recording I plan on uploading to Wayu Torah, which is where a lot of people access audio classes. So you don't have to worry about if you didn't put up on enough makeup or whatever else you put on today, everything will be fine. Anyway, let's go to our sheet now. And I'll tell you what we did last time. So last time what we learned together, we began learning Ramban's Shaar HaGmul. And again, this text, as far as I've seen from doing a few cursory Google searches, it does not, I haven't found any translations that are available online. But I'll tell you what, two things. One is I see it as part of my job as a rabbi is to actually take texts that are less accessible and try to make them more accessible for a broader audience. So the fact that this isn't easily something that many people could pick up, read, and fully understand and appreciate is specifically why I chose to teach a class like this. Number two, the other preface I gave last time is that if for some reason you don't like following along here in the text, think of it as a supplement, which means that anything I say, in theory, you could just not even be looking at your screen. You have your eyes closed and just be listening to what I say. You should be able to get everything from the sheet. The idea of me giving you a PDF of the part of the book we're doing is really just to supplement is to supplement the class. Okay, so any questions, housekeeping questions before we jump in? Welcome Toby and welcome Marina. Great. Okay. So previously on Shaar HaGmul, it's like one of those TV episodes. Previously on Shaar HaGmul, what we discovered was that there are four categories. There are four types of people on Rosh Hashanah. Originally, we looked at a Gemara that said that there are three categories. One are tzaddikim gemurim, fully righteous people who go straight, who have get judged on Rosh Hashanah, and immediately God writes them in the book of life, and they live a happy, perfect, wonderful, blissful life here on earth. And then we said, on the opposite extreme, we have the rishayim gemurim. Those who are fully wicked, who are the consummate evil in this world, and they get immediately written in the book of death. And then there's the Beinonim, the people who are in between. We'll say they're 50-50 right now, 50-50 good deeds, 50-50 bad deeds. And they get suspended from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur. And during the Aseres Mei Teshuva, the 10 days of repentance, it's a chance for them to tip the scales to the good side so that they can merit to be in the book of good life. Now, the question that many of us asked last time is that, wait a minute, and this is the Ramban's question. Don't we look out into the world and don't we see many people who are wicked, yet they prosper? And don't we see many people who are good and yet they suffer? So how can the Gemara tell us that tzaddik and gemurim, completely righteous people live blissful lives, and wicked people get smitten by God right away? That's hachush machish. If you look out to the world, that is just not the facts on the ground. It's the opposite. So the Ramban said, well, we have to actually distinguish here. When we say tzaddikim gemurim and we say rishayim gemurim, that we mean literally completely righteous people. We mean pristine. We mean that they never committed a single sin in their entire life. And the thing is, even someone we mentioned last time, as great as Moshe Rabbeinu, one of the greatest leaders or the greatest leader of the Jewish people, he sinned as well. We just learned about that. So did he hit the rock? Did he accuse the Jews? Whatever it may have been. But even someone as great as Moshe Rabbeinu, he at least had one or two sins under his belt. So the thing is, it's more of a theoretical category. There's very few people, if at all, that fall to the category of completely righteous. And even those who are considered the consummate evil, there has to have been at least something they did in their life at some point that constitutes a mitzvah. They must have, helped someone cross the street or maybe like given a penny to charity. That's enough not to make them rishayim gemurim. But then we said there's two other categories. There's someone who is complete majority mitzvos, and minority, he also committed a few averus on the side. So what God does for a person like that is actually counterintuitive. He actually makes a person who is majority good deeds suffer in this world, and he makes someone who's majority bad deeds prosper in this world. The reason is so that someone who performed majority good deeds in his life, he'll be able to enjoy and reap the rewards in the world to come. So that way he suffers a limited punishment, a limited suffering, a finite punishment in this world. So in the next world, he reaps all the benefit. Whereas someone who is a majority wicked deeds, but then did a few mitzvahs on the side, he gets all of his reward in this world, and he suffers the consequences of his evil actions in the world to come. And that is...
Excuse me, I have a question.
Yes.
I have a question. The little bit I've studied about Catholicism, their philosophy was that if people suffered on earth, that was really very good because they'd have a good life later on. And this was a way of keeping people down and subservient and not to revolt against their leaders, et cetera, who took advantage. I mean, did this approach come from Jewish text?
Mm-hmm. So I think you're right, Susan. And it's not just Catholicism. I remember when I was, I can't say I've read a lot of, I think it was Plato when he describes his utopia. So he actually says we have to invent a religion in order so that we can maintain the hierarchy. Because if we can use people aren't going to be happy to be on the lower end of the spectrum, right? Everyone wants to be living in Darien or the other, whatever those nice neighborhoods are down there that I've traveled to, right? Everyone wants to be there. So no one's going to be happy living in the slums in the city. So, but wait, if we can invent a religion that tells you that you deserve to be there and I deserve to be prospering, then people will listen because it's divine will. So you're absolutely right. It's not just, I don't know Catholicism well enough, you seem to, but it's definitely a trend that many politicians have appropriated religion for the purpose of validating their prosperity and also validating why others are not prospering. So I totally hear that. Actually, I think we're going to get to it not today. It'll be in our next section. We're going to talk about briefly how there are kings that if they use religion to get people to serve them instead of serving God, they actually get the worst kind of punishment along with the biggest Rishayim and wicked people that existed. So I like the point you're bringing up. And I think definitely we're going to see if the Ramban is sensitive to the idea of corrupt leaders utilizing religion for the purpose for their own purposes. So thank you for bringing that up, Susan.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, so now that was all by way of review, which I'm glad I brought that up because that question came up. Now we're going to continue. Now that we laid out the different kinds of people and who suffers in this world, who gets more of their reward in the next world, we need to define a few terms. You see, Ramban completely reinterpreted that Gemara. So the Gemara, if we recall, said that the righteous people get immediately put in the book of life and the wicked people get put in the book of death. So here's the thing. What does it mean by, what do we mean when we say life? What do we mean when we say death? Here's another explanation to try to understand why we don't see wicked people being struck by lightning immediately when they commit a sin and why we don't see righteous people prospering. So here's the thing. V'chein zeh she'amru chachamim, Zichron levracha, lechaim ulamisa. When our rabbis in the Gemara said that there's life and there's death, ena b'yamin belvad, it doesn't mean that a completely wicked person or someone who needs to get cleansed and purged in this world so he could reap the reward in the world to come, it doesn't mean necessarily that their days will be shortened, that they'll die, but there's alternative actions that we call misa, alternative circumstances. Ela kol ha'onshim, this refers to any kind of suffering in this world, not necessarily death. Negayim, va'oni, umisa, banuch yosman. If someone's going to suffer from different kinds of sicknesses, someone suffers from poverty, if someone suffers from losing children, God forbid, Kulan kinu osan chachamim. This, all the Rabbanan, all the rabbis, they codenamed it b'shem misa. They called it death. V'kino haschar v'agmul hatov amru b'loshon chayim. And any reward is also called chayim. So it's really not, you know, someone could be wicked. They could be actually being punished in this world, or a righteous person could be suffering in this world. And when we talk about the book of life and the book of death, it doesn't mean literally life or death. Life can mean living in tranquility, but you might not live a long life. And the book of death means, it can mean suffering, but you can still live a very long life. So what the Ramban does is he adds a layer of nuance to this discussion. It's not a bifurcation of a dichotomy of either life or death, but there's actually a spectrum in between, right? So that's a very popular thing to do nowadays. It's not one extreme or the other, but it's actually a spectrum of Chaim and Misa. So that's what the Ramban says, just to define another term for us. Another thing, we're going to delve into this in a later class in more depth. Ramban assumes there's an argument whether what we're being judged for on Rosh Hashanah. So if I were to ask you, what is God judging for on Rosh Hashanah? Is he judging for this world or for the world to come? For our lot in the world to come, what would you say? Based on what we've seen.
This world.
Right. So we've been primed by the Ramban until now, who assumes that Rosh Hashanah is a judgment on Olam Hazeh, the world we're in right now. However, we're going to see later that some Rishonim, some medieval philosophers, actually think that the judgment of Rosh Hashanah is for our lot in the world to come. And there'll be questions about, wait a minute, doesn't that need to be constantly reassessed because I perform an additional mitzvah, maybe that'll get me onto a higher level in the world to come. We'll address that later. But we'll see just the Ramban for now. He says, Zeh adin shamar chacham zichron lebracha, shechol adam nidom rosh hashana, ino im yizke laganeinu l'chaylam haba, o im yizchayev l'gehenem, vavadon, she'in adam nidom rosh hashana, el an yonei ha'olam hazeh, imor l'chayev ha'shava, olam mitzv yisurim. So what are we being judged for in this world on Rosh Hashanah? We're being judged on not for whether we're going to heaven, not for whether we're going to burn in hell, we'll talk about even those definitions later on, what exactly is heaven, what exactly is hell, that's a later part of Shaar Gemul. But rather, what are we being judged for on Rosh Hashanah? Al Inyanei Ha'olam Hazeh. Just on our welfare in this world. Whether we'll live a life of tranquility, or whether we die or have suffering. That's what the purpose of Rosh Hashanah is. And then the Ramban backs us up with a few verses as a proof to that. That's a lot of footnotes there in one moment. So here we go. Kach amru chacham zichron levracha. Zeh ayom tchilas masecha zichron yom rishon. Kichol kisrohu mishpel hei Yaakov. So this is part of Zichronos that we read in the Musaf Shmona Esrei on Rosh Hashanah. And when it's talking about the judgment on Rosh Hashanah, what does it say? When it talks about God, God doesn't just judge the individuals. He doesn't just judge you and me. He also judges countries, medinos, provinces, areas as a collective. So in theory, according to Jewish theology, there are angels assigned to every nation, and every nation has a certain verdict that is made by God on Rosh Hashanah. Ezo l'cherev, ezo l'sham, who will suffer from the sword? Who will suffer from war? Who will merit peace? Ezo l'rav, ezo l'sova, who will suffer from hunger? Who will be satiated? Ubrios bo yafkilas kiyom l'chayim l'maves. And then God also is judging every living being as well. El kachi amida, Rosh Hashanah sholkim asa shal adam, so God judges on Rosh Hashanah, do we live, do we die? And only when someone passes away when someone enters the next world, does God have to determine what your lot is in the world to come? So just a quick definition of terms. Ramban refers to, has anyone ever heard the term Olam HaNeshamos? Does that ring a bell at all?
No.
So this was a new term for me when I started looking into this article as well. So usually what we're accustomed to hearing, I would imagine, is there's something called Gan Eden, there's something called Gehenna, there's something called Olam Haba. Those might be terms we've heard about. So there's something called Olam HaNeshamos, which essentially is, Ramban believes that in the, and this is a whole different section of Shaar HaGmul, he believes that in the end of days, that's when the world to come, this spiritual concept called the world to come, comes into existence. But the question is, what if you're not part of that generation, of that messianic generation? What if you were like any other human over the past thousands of years who passed away before all this eschatology came into play? So where does God keep you in the meantime? So God has this this temporary heaven, this temporary world to come, which is called the Olam HaNeshamos, the world of the souls, where God keeps those souls in the meantime until the full culmination of heaven is supposed to come to fruition. Now, what that looks like practically, I think Ramban gets to later on, but that's just a good term to be aware of, how he adds a layer of nuance to understanding what we call heaven in Jewish theology. Okay, so I think, is that the, so good. So now we just finished the section. Everything that we've been learning the previous time and until now deals with the question of judgment on Rosh Hashanah. What we're going to do in future sessions is we're going to look at judgment after someone passes away. And then after that section, Ramban gets into the question, the real questions of theodicy, the book of Job, and he really delves deeper into the question of why bad things happen to good people. And I think if when we get there, he lists about 5 to 6 different reasons of why righteous people suffer and wicked people prosper. So that's something, just the way your appetite, that we'll get to later. This is the end of a section, so I want to take questions before we go further. Toby, I see you're raising your hand.
Yeah, I guess I'm still a little baffled. So you're saying, according to the Ramban, we are not being judged for the world to come at this point, only for the world here. Mm-hmm. So based upon putting it all together, we have to assume that if we are suffering in this world, it's because we're more good than bad. And if we're happy in this world, not happy, but if we're having a good life in this world, we're more bad than good.
Right. If I get your question, Toby, it's that, wait a minute, what about us who aren't particularly suffering this world? Does that mean that we're bad people?
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, is that the question? Okay, excellent. So, great. Another question that leads us to something we'll talk about later on, which is there's a Gemara that says, I think if 40 days pass by and nothing bad happens to you, you got to be really worried. So here's the thing. It's true that God makes us suffer in this world, so we don't suffer in the world to come, if we are rov zechuyos, if we are majority good deeds. But the level of suffering, so I think what Ramban would say is that the level of suffering could differ. So, you know, you could be, in theory, I'm just thinking about this as you bring it up, someone could be a very righteous person, and they have a few averos that they have to atone for. So what God might do is he might, you know, spread out that suffering throughout, you know, it doesn't have to all be in one day. It doesn't have to be like there's a tragic car accident. It could be that you even, you have a limp in your foot and you have to go for like 2 years and suffer from that uncomfortable limping foot that you have. So I think the point of the Ramban saying that that suffering is all sorts of different things that can happen. It's not limited to someone, God forbid, losing a child, but it could be even minor inconveniences over a span of time. I think that it really leaves open that option. And that's where I think Mida Kenegamida comes in as well, which it gives God the latitude to try to frame, at least, and I'm just saying this is how Jewish theology understands it. God will make us suffer in a way that's commensurate or that resembles the sin that we committed. And the belief is that hopefully it could try to make us think of what we did to bring that upon us. Now, is that a good advice from a pastoral perspective? I have my doubts. Trust me, if someone comes over to me and says that they have problems, they're suffering from something, my first question to them is not, well, what do you think you did wrong to deserve it? That's, I think that'd be close to rabbinic malpractice. Yeah. But I agree with your question, which is, wait a minute, why are, you know, does that mean if I'm not suffering to an extreme degree in this world, does that mean I have to worry? And that will be a question that Ramban is going to deal with later on. So we'll just hold tight on that, but that's the brief answer for now.
And I have one more related question. And then I'll stop asking questions. So let's say year one, you know, I'm praying for something, God says no, I'm suffering. Year two, I'm praying for something, God says no, I'm suffering. And this goes on. And then we get to year five, and God grants me my wish in this world. Mm-hmm. And now, Baruch Hashem, I'm happy. Mm-hmm. Should I be worried about that? I mean, so, does that have an implication for the world to come? If suffering was alleviated in this world?
You're adding in a new factor, which I think is important as well. I think you brought in tshuva last time, and now you're bringing in tefillah, prayer. Right. So again, God apparently has some sort of calculus, right? This is the understanding. There's some sort of calculus that God has that is beyond our comprehension, or at least we're just not privy to understanding. But the idea is that someone could have a particular verdict, and they could pray to God and overturn that verdict. That's precisely what we're doing when we're praying on high holidays. And that's precisely what Moshe Rabbeinu tried doing. Moshe Rabbeinu prayed to God, please let me into the land of Israel, even though I was punished. And God said to tell him to stop praying because he knew that if Moshe continued to pray, it would somehow overturn the original verdict upon him. So there definitely is, again, I cannot, and Ramban is going to say it's at some point as well, at a certain point, it is a certain level of speculation, but we are laying out that there are different factors in the equation. One of those factors is prayer. So someone, and we say, tshuva tefilo tztaka, avir nesro ha-gzera. We say that repentance, and we also say that doing the fasting and prayer is a tzedakah, charity, is able to overturn a verdict. So I think you're right. I think prayer is a part of the equation that Ramban has not yet explored, at least in this section of the book. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Yeah. Does anyone, I can't see everyone in one shot. So anyone else have a question that I'm missing? Okay. Toby, I don't know if you're satisfied with that answer.
But I said I wouldn't ask anymore, so we'll go on.
You know, what's interesting is I don't know if we'll get to this, but there later on in the book, Ramban actually says there's a bit of a debate about what we call emuna pshuta. And I know it's a little bit of a tangent, but it's really related. So when I grew up, I was always told that the most pristine form of commitment to God, if you want to have the strongest form of fidelity to our religion, you don't ask questions. You have what we call emuna pshuta, simple faith, blind faith. And that's considered to be the highest level where I don't have any questions on God. But Ramban actually later in the book, he says that, no, you're specifically supposed to make inquiries. And it's actually, you're supposed to try to delve into the theological depths of Judaism to the best of your ability. Otherwise, why is he writing this book over here, right? So there's
and
actually...
Ramban would certainly agree with that.
What was that?
Rambam would certainly agree that we're supposed to delve in question and learn and...
Right. So the interesting thing with Rambam, there's another book, of course, I'm sure many of us are familiar with, called The Guide to the Perplexed, which is Rambam's Mor Nebuchim, which is his theological treatise. So Rambam actually says he writes the book because there is a lot of heresy, and there's a lot, and philosophy was very popular in his days. So he wrote the Mor Nebuchim as a response to all the Jews who were reading philosophy from elsewhere. And then what he tries to do is frame the philosophy, a Jewish philosophy, in a way that will keep people from going wayward and away from Jewish religion. So that's just interesting to note as well. But yes, there is a separate shiur to be given, which I have done in the past, about the debate of whether it's better to make philosophical inquiries or whether a moon of Shuta is something to train people toward. So if you have a chance, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, who passed away recently, was also grandfather of Yali Drach in the community. So he wrote an essay, which is now part of a book called Faith and Doubt. And the name of that essay is Faith and Doubt, where he explores the question of should we be questioning and how does one deal with doubt in Judaism? What's Judaism's approach to someone who has doubt? So that's I bring this all in by way of saying I appreciate the questions. And I think Ramban also appreciates the challenges and inquiries to his theological system. Anyway, we end at 10 o'clock, right? Okay, good. Yeah. Good. So we still have a little bit of time. Any other questions? Because we're about to do another section now. Okay. So I just want to orient you again with the Tzur Sadaf of the page. On the top over here is just the Ramban and Shar HaGmul. Every now and then, there are some really great footnotes, which was written by, it's called a Chazon Yoel, and it was written by some rabbi who I think is actually a contemporary. He's alive today. And what he does is he delves deeper into the Ramban. He asks questions that you and I would likely ask, or questions that we wouldn't likely ask, but he's an expert in Ramban and understands it. And many times, not in the piece we're going to see now, but in other pieces, he'll bring in the Rambam, he'll bring in other Rishonim that disagree with the Ramban. So this particular piece we're going to see is a question within the Ramban system, just to show you that we're not the only ones asking questions. So here we go. Lefiyam avur v'samach, that which we see later on in the Ramban. In Yesha other mak mitzvos, let's say someone is 100% mitzvos. The ain lo shum avonos. Nosin lo schar gabo mazev v'gal moha ba. So if I am totally good, not only will I get reward in the next world, I get reward in this world. Umi sheisho rov mitzvos v'mir avonos v'sham lo schar mitzvos v'gal moha ba. And someone who's majority mitzvos only gets their reward in the next world, and for the most part, has their atonement in this world. Umi sheisho rov avonos v'mir mitzvos, and someone who's majority sin, we said that you get your mitzvos, that you get your schar in this world. That we know. The issue is, there's a contradiction within the Ramban's own thought between this book, Shar HaGmul, and Ramban in his Eirush Al HaTorah, his commentary on the Bible. Ramban writes, Ramban writes, Vida, and this comes, I think Toby brought up this point last time, the way we get rewarded is based on our orientation when we perform mitzvos. If someone does mitzvos just for the sake of receiving reward in this world, this person will live many years in this world with wealth and with great property, it would be covered with honor, but he won't get his reward in the world to come if he's working specifically for a reward in this world. This is category number two. I realize I only went back later to the book and I demarcated which categories are which. There are three categories. There's a person who does work in this world, who performs mitzvos so you can receive reward in this world. Then there's category number two, which is someone who works and performs mitzvos so he can be rewarded the olam hava, in the world to come. Shem ovdim meyir, they serve God out of fear in order so that they, look, you know, I want to go to heaven. I don't want to burn in hell. So it's a utilitarian, Pascal's wager kind of idea that, look, I'll follow God and I'll follow mitzvos. And I expect to be compensated for my time and be given a reward in the world to come. That's category number two. And category number Someone who serves God out of genuine love. That I just want to serve God because he is God and he is the source of all goodness, and that which he commands is objectively good. Okay. So category number one, let's break it down. Category number one, someone who works for reward in this world gets a reward in this world. Someone who, but category number two and number three go together. If I serve God out of fear to get reward in the world to come, or I serve God out of love, then I get my reward in the world to come. The issue is as follows. Let's say I perform only a few mitzvos lishma. Here's the problem. The way Rabban spells out reward and punishment in this book that we're learning, Shaar HaGmul, is that it's quantitative. If I am 51% mitzvos, my reward is given to me in the world to come. If I'm 51% sin, then I get my reward in this world. But over here, it's qualitative. I can perform only a few mitzvahs my entire life, but if I do them lishma, so I do it either to get reward in the world to come, or I do it because I had a few moments where I just wanted to because I loved God, but the rest of my time, I'm just out there and committing kol davar aser, every sin under the sun. Even still, because of those few mitzvahs I did lishma, I get to get my reward in the world to come. There's a contradiction here. Right, so that's the question. The question is that in one place, Rambam makes it sound over here, quantitative, that's about percentages. And in his Perush al Torah, his commentary on the Torah, he says, when do you get your reward in the world to come? When you do for the right reasons. Even if you're less than 50% good deeds. That's a contradiction in the Ramban. Do we have any, just I'll take questions if this question is not clear, because that's what we're going to answer now.
Yeah, Rabbi, please tell me again. I missed the name of this rabbi who we're talking about now.
Oh, okay. Let me.
I just wanted to write it down.
Absolutely. This is written by. You know what? Yoel Yaakov Spirka.
Spirka?
It's spelled Samech Pei Reish Kuf A. Okay. Yeah. I've only heard him in the context of his commentary on Shaar HaGmul. So he's a little bit of a new name to me as well. Anyway, so he notes this contradiction in the Ramban. Is it quantitative or qualitative that gets me into Olam Haba, the world to come? That gives me the reward. So the answer is as follows. If we look at a number of commentaries like the Shla, we look at the Nefesh HaChaim, which is Rechaim V'Lajner, and we look at a number of other more, let's talk like 18th century, somewhere in that area, Jewish thinkers. They say we've been misunderstanding reward and punishment this whole time. The Schar Adam, Eino Tashlim Habalo Schar Hanaslo Min HaChutz. I tend to think of reward and punishment as I perform a mitzvah, I get reward for it. God stipulates a business transaction. So if I keep to my end of the bargain, I perform a mitzvah, God gives me X amount of reward. And that's the way many people think of reward and punishment, including myself. But what they say is no, that's not how reward and punishment works. Rather, you perform a mitzvah. I think there's some background music coming from somewhere. So I think I know. Okay, thank you. I guess, you know, some people hold the 3 weeks begins tomorrow, so we all have our opinions of when music stops. Anyway, so I'm going to just be mocking for today. So like what we were saying, when I perform a mitzvah, it's a byproduct of my mitzvah that I happen to get reward. It's not a business transaction. That's not how we think of it. Therefore, and we see over here, L'chein masha adam bona va'osa, u'mashi yelo b'lamava, that which we do in this world, waits for us in the world to come. This is what the rabbis say in Maseches Avodah Zarah, Gimel and Aleph. Someone who works on Erev Shabbos on Friday will have what to eat on Shabbos. Someone who doesn't work on Friday won't have what to eat on Shabbos. That's a metaphor for working in this world in order so that we have something waiting for us in the world to come. It's not a reward and punishment. It's a byproduct for actions. Meaning, if I decide, my wife asks me to go shopping today or tomorrow, and I neglect to go shopping, I'm not being punished that I don't have a meal to eat over Shabbos. It's simply a result. It's a result of I have some technical difficulty here. It's a result of not going shopping. God's not punishing me. I decide not to go shopping, so I don't have food for Shabbos. That's how it works. It's naturalistic, if you will. My reward and punishment is just simply a result of our actions. They're a natural byproduct. And what that means for us is as follows. Now we can explain the Ramban. So we're not going to go through all of this. This part we should see inside. When Ramban writes in the Torah that we get rewarded based on our kavana, based on our intentions when we perform a mitzvah. If I am performing mitzvos so that I get rewarded in this world, that's what I want. Then I am categorically a olam hazeh person. If I only work for this world, I am a planet Earth. This world person. If I do mitzvos in order to get reward in the world to come, or I do it lishma, I do it for the sake of God alone, then I am categorically an olam haba person, because that's why I perform my mitzvos. And this gets to our discussion last time, Toby, about why when I perform certain mitzvos, part of what determines when I get rewarded for it is why I'm doing it. If I only perform mitzvahs because I want to get reward in this world, then my reward is in this world. But if I do it because I want reward in the next world, or I do it because I just want to serve God, my reward is in the world to come. And based on that, we can answer the contradiction. So now we actually have two criteria to get your reward in the world to come. You thought things were hard enough. Now it gets a little harder. The Ba'inan Rov Mitzvos, Kamosha Kasavkan, the Gam Lishma. So not only do you need to be quantitatively 51% mitzvos, but qualitatively, you need to also have in mind to be doing it for the right reasons. And the right reasons doesn't have to be the most laudable and noble intent. It could literally just be, I want to be rewarded in the world to come. God, please, give me reward for my mitzvos. That's good enough. That's all you need. So now you need both criteria. You need to have rov mitzvos, majority mitzvos, the gam lishma, and doing it for one of those two reasons. And what that means is that if someone has only one, let's say I have 51% mitzvos, but I don't do it for right reasons, then I don't get my reward in olam haba. And if I do mitzvos for the right reason, but I just live my whole life as a sinner primarily, that even if I did a few mitzvahs for the right reason, clearly by virtue of me spending most of my time occupying myself committing sins on this earth, I still am categorically, I see myself as a person who seeks to get the most out of this world and not the most out of the world to come. That's the Ramban's approach. Now, Toby, you just tell me if this is going to be your question, all right? The question that we're going to get to next and we're going to end with is, wait a minute, don't we say everyone has a portion in the world to come? Was that going to be it, or do you have another question?
No, totally different question.
Totally different one. Let's get it in quickly because we have 4 minutes.
Okay, what if I do a mitzvah today? Let's say I give tzedakah because I want to have the joy, so to speak, of seeing somebody who was hungry not being hungry anymore. Mm-hmm. And that makes me feel good. So what category is that? Is that this world? Is the next world?
Very good. So what he's leaving out is, and this is it's another good point, Toby. The issue is that he seems to be talking about ritual mitzvos, where it's about between me and God. What about bein adam lechavero, between me and my fellow man? Where does that come in? I'll just quickly put in that, and this is a sermon topic that I've done before.
Which, another class. It's just I wanted to get the question
I'll give you a question right now. The answer is that we're not only supposed to perform mitzvos because it gives us, because we think it's good, because it feels good, because many times there are things that the world tells us are good and we feel good about it, but the Torah actually tells us it's a sin. So the Torah wants to do is not just to perform good deeds because it makes us happy or fulfilled to perform a good deed, or because we love seeing the children smile. That's definitely a good thing to have as a midah in your nature. But part of that equation doesn't mean 100% only because God told me to do so, but that needs to be a part of the equation. So when I perform tzedakah, I'm not only doing it for the children to smile, but I'm doing it because God told me to give tzedakah as well. There's a whole talk about Avram Avinu and the Akedah. That's for another time, but thanks for bringing that up. Let's do this outside because we have 2 minutes. The question is, there is a classic Gemara in Perek Chelek and Sanhedrin, and we say when we learn Pirkei Avos that says, Kol Yisrael Yisham Chelek Olam Haba, every Jew has a portion of the world to come. So wait a minute, what's with this whole 51%? Am I doing it for the right reasons? That means to say, if I'm not in those categories, I don't get reward in the world to come. But wait a minute, except for a few wicked people and exceptions that are listed there, like Yerubba ben Nevat, otherwise, everyone, we say, every Jew has a portion of the world to come. So what is the Rabban talking about? What do you mean you have the 51% mitzvos and lishma? What do you mean? Every Jew has a portion of the world to come. So that's a huge question that's asked here. And the answer briefly is as follows. By virtue of being a Jew, and look at this, you know, there's something, I'm guilty of this, right? So sometimes there are people who are very frum and very orthodox, and they like to bash the idea of Jewish identity, right? Like Jewish identity is just a very vague terminology. What does it actually mean? So I always thought that way, still do to a certain extent. But actually, there's a source that backs up this idea, this value of just simply identifying as a Jew, even if you don't keep halacha, even if you have a hard time keeping the mitzvos. He says as follows. That based on Pasuk Yishayahu, b'shem Yisrael yichaneh, that you'll be called by the name Israel, who below Torah, below mitzvos, even if I don't keep the Torah mitzvos, rak shemechanes atzem b'shem Yisrael, v'aval pi kein yesh lo schar. Even if I just identify as a Jew, there is still some form of reward that is waiting for me in the world to come. What is the Ramban talking about? You need to be 51% mitzvos, and you need to get schar, and you need to do for right reasons? He says that's the reach, la'od chelag yoser maus madregas b'olam haba. If you want to be like a ben olam haba, sometimes we say that you have a chelag in olam haba, you have a portion of the world to come. But if you want to be a ben olam haba, not just someone who happened to make it in on a technicality, but you want to be someone who really earned it to be there, then okay, you need to be 51% mitzvos. You need to be able to perform mitzvos for the right reasons. But every Jew, as long as you identify as a Jew and you are a decent person, even if you don't reach those qualifications, we say in the Mishnah, Yesh lahem chelek la'olam haba. And this is a really important idea that we needed to fit in the end, because otherwise we're going to walk away from this year thinking, oh my God, all my friends are Jews who aren't, let's say, 51% mitzvahs, or they're not doing it for the right reasons, they're all going to burn in hell. The answer is no. Even the Ramban would agree, Kol Yisrael Yishem Chelek Olam Haba, everyone has a place in the world to come. But if you want to be someone who earned the place and have the VIP seats, as it were, then you got to reach those qualifications. But not to worry, everyone at least still has, even if you don't make it to business or first class, everyone at least has economy class seating in the world to come. That's the idea of the Chazon Yo on the Ramban. And that's why I want to explore the footnotes here, because it really adds an extra dimension and nuance and layer to what we saw earlier. So we are out of time now. I will stay on if anyone has any additional questions. But otherwise, you are welcome to go. Thank you for joining us for our second installment. For those who are fasting, have an easy fast, and I look forward to learning together next week.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Or any questions, we're all done. Okay, excellent. Have a great day, everyone. I'm going to log off.
You have an easy fast.
Thank you. Much appreciated.